Well, I'm delighted to be here. I'm embarrassed that Eric remembers me dancing. I always say of the Dutch Reformed clergy that we have spent centuries trying to breed all sense of rhythm out of our people and have largely succeeded. But I was saved late in life, so I could dance a little bit. And my wife is Hungarian, so she has very good rhythm. And it's wonderful to be here. I remember attending Eric's ordination, and it was a relatively small gathering of people because it was in the afternoon, and the presbytery was represented, and a few people from the seminary and other denominations were there. And I was sitting next to Mike Horton in the back of the sanctuary, and we were invited to come forward and congratulate Eric after the ordination. And Mike and I are talking to one another, and we're watching all these PCA ministers hugging one another. And we decided that we would maintain the purity of the Dutch Reformed faith. And shook his hand with a very stiff, straight arm. So, do you remember that?
I do.
Anyway, it is great to be here. It is great to have an opportunity to think about something of the history of the church. Eric initially asked me that I would speak on who you ought to vote for. I decided that was too tame a topic, and I didn't want to get into anything that, frivolous. But as we think about the elections, one of the things that has struck me, having had an opportunity to observe a number of elections over the years, I think the first election I really remember, I was alive for others, but I really remember Eisenhower against Stevenson in 1952. Hardly a soul is yet alive, is the polarization of the country today. Whoever side you're on, you have to grant that the country is seriously polarized, and that there is a lot of anger and a lot of confusion and a lot of frustration on all sides. And it seems to me that is more true in the last maybe 4 to 8 years than has been true in the history of the country at large. Now, whenever anybody tells you these are the worst of times, you ought to smile and say, well, you should go talk to a historian. We've had a lot of bad times in this country. We've had a lot of bad presidents. We've had a lot of tensions. But it does seem that there is a particular level of frustration and leading to confusion and or anger in our time. And I find it a little bit frustrating as a historian that I don't see very many people trying to analyze why that is. Why are there so many people supporting one candidate or the other and absolutely convinced that the republic may well come to an end if the opponent wins? Should we think that way? Are things that bad off? Why are people so troubled? Why are people so troubled? And how should we, as Christians, particularly relate to that? This was brought home to me by a friend who is a Presbyterian, but he hangs out with some very influential Roman Catholics, and had an opportunity to speak to a very influential Roman Catholic cleric, and said to that man, we have lots of angry people in our churches. Is that true in Roman Catholic churches? And this Roman Catholic cleric smiled and said, no. And my friend looked very perplexed and said, why is that? Why are the people in our churches so angry and the people in your churches not? And this Roman Catholic smiled and said, because we never thought the country belonged to us. And I think that really is at the heart of a lot of what is going on. Those of us who are Protestants, persuaded Protestants, committed Protestants, but even a lot of people who aren't, recognize that things have really changed in this country. And they don't understand what has changed and why it's changed and what it means and what it means for the church. And so I'm going to explain it all to you. It's about time somebody did, yeah. You'll be surprised to learn, in order to understand what's going on, we have to look at history. It's history that will really help us understand. And as a historian, I've always said there are two kinds of historians, which the famous Princeton historian Lawrence Stone once said, historians are either lumpers or choppers. They either lump everything together and want to talk about continuities, how things really haven't changed that much, or they're choppers, constantly dividing things up and saying, oh, look how much has changed, how much has changed. Well, by nature, I'm a lumper. I like to emphasize continuities and to say, oh, things haven't changed as much as you think. But in the last 10 years, in terms of the times we're living through, I've become a chopper. I think the reason we're confused and sometimes angry and certainly frustrated is that we are living through one of the most consequential changes in the history of Western civilization in 1,500 years. And nobody seems to have noticed, except me. Which should immediately put you on guard to suspect everything I say from this point on. But it does mean if we're going to take the big picture, if we're going to look at the big picture, if we're going to look back and figure out what has changed, what was the character of things before the big change, what was the nature of the big change, and what do we do now? Those are sort of the three lectures. We need to take a long look at history. And we need to look at the whole history of the church in America. So for 250 years, the church in America has been living, developing, changing, often thriving. And we want to look at that. So tonight's lecture is flourishing, the church flourishing. What made the church flourish in America? But the American church experience is a part of the broader experience of the church in the West, which has been following a line of life and development that goes all the way back to the Emperor Constantine and his reign in the early 4th century. Most of you weren't alive then. That's a very long time ago. That's a very long time ago. But the decision of the Emperor Constantine and emperors who came after him to adopt Christianity and begin to make Christianity the legal established religion of the West has cast a huge shadow over Western history and over the history of the church. And there's a very fine book, a very scholarly book, that has appeared in the last year by Peter Heather called Christendom. Christendom. And he talks about the beginning of Christendom and traces about the first 1,000 years. So he doesn't get very far. He only gets to 1,200. But his argument is absolutely fascinating. And his argument is that with the decision of the emperors to embrace Christianity and establish Christianity, Christianity began to enjoy the privileges of legal protection and legal support from the state. And that legal protection included the use of the coercive power of the state to enforce certain things about Christianity. So for hundreds and hundreds of years, in the West, Christianity enjoyed a privileged position where the government supported Christianity and to one extent or another opposed other religions. And therefore, Christians enjoyed a protected, encouraged, supported condition in the countries in which they lived in the West. That was true in what we today look back on as the Byzantine Empire in Eastern Europe and Turkey and Egypt, parts of Northern Africa. For centuries, the churches there were established and flourishing and legally protected. It was true in the West as the Western Empire eventually broke off from the Eastern Empire and had its own history and developed its own branch of Christianity, the Roman Catholic Church. Roman Catholics want to tell you that what they do is what's always been done. It's not true. It's just not true. We don't have time for me to get off on that. But I always love it. I'm fascinated to watch history in play. So when they're electing a new pope, I'm glued to the television. And they always, you know, show you the crowds in St. Peter's Square waiting for the election of the new pope. And they always have some priest who, in a very muffled voice, says, "What you're seeing now has been going on for 2,000 years. And I want to say, "No, it hasn't." That's not true at all. But anyway, that's, you should worry that I'll get off on a tangent. That's a besetting sin of the elderly. And when the church was founded in America, it was very much founded as still a part of Christendom. Now, the Reformation had put pressures on Christendom because now in the West we had more than one church. We had a Roman Catholic Church, and we had Lutheran churches, and we had Reformed churches. And what kind of church would there be in the New World? And I want to look a little bit at what was happening in America under the headings, first of all, of culture, what's happening culturally in America, and then what's happening in churches in America. And culturally, we have a new world. We have a new world that's been discovered and is being colonized over time. And in that new world, initially, everyone kept looking eastward. Everyone kept looking back to Europe. They lived on the Atlantic coast. And they kept looking, most of them, back to England. For their culture, for their ways of thinking, for their religion. And only gradually did the New World begin to look west. In 1835, Lyman Beecher, a Congregational minister, wrote a book called The Plea for the West. And he said, we have to start thinking about how the future of our country is to be found in the West. That increasingly, people are leaving the East Coast and beginning to settle further and further west, and we have to make plans for how we're going to plant churches in the West, how we're going to carry civilization into the West, what we're going to do when we reach all the way to the West Coast and run into those Spanish governments and that dreaded Roman Catholic religion. What are we going to do? Lyman Beecher asked. So people began to look westward. And the reality of the presence of land, and much of it good, productive land, was one of the ways that really formed the character of America and of Americans. I had a professor when I was in college who wrote a book. He was a professor of American history, which those of us who are Reformation historians called journalism. He wrote a wonderful book called A People of Plenty. He said, what has marked America in any number of ways is the plenty, the abundance of land, of natural resources. People would come to wild, crazy places like Texas, and there may not be quite as good farmland in Texas as there is further north, but there's ranges for cattle, and then black gold. So there are all sorts of ways in which plenty came to manifest itself in the Western extension. And the New World then came to adopt a new form of government. Eventually, the Americans threw off the control of England and the British Empire and established a republic that threw off monarchy and landed aristocracy and insisted that we would be a meritocracy. Well, mostly, or at least for some of us. It was certainly true that there was much more opportunity in America for advancement than there would have been for most people in similar circumstances in Europe. In Europe, there wasn't land to expand to. There weren't new frontiers to be pursued. But we have to be realistic, as is very much true now, that meritocracy was not true for everyone. It wasn't true for women, who faced great difficulty. Do you know how long the average marriage lasted in America in the early 19th century? 12 years. Because so many women died in childbirth. The death rate, not just of the children, but of the mothers, was staggering because they didn't know anything about hygiene. And therefore, there was a huge death rate. And men often ended up remarrying within days. They were on the frontier with little children in a farm. They couldn't survive without a wife. And so it was not all Little House on the Prairie romance. It was a struggle for survival. And of course, slaves certainly did not have an opportunity for equal treatment. But there was planted in the American ideal a movement towards greater extension of merit and opportunity. And one of the moments in American history when that was interestingly illustrated was the election of Andrew Jackson in 1828 to be president. He was the first American president who wasn't from the East Coast, who wasn't connected to the great founders of the American Republic, wasn't associated with the Revolution. And Thomas Bailey, one of the great American historians, observed, "With the election of Andrew Jackson, power passed from the snobs to the mobs." Now, that may not be precisely accurate, but it captures something of the changing mood. No longer Virginia planters, but this crazy guy from Tennessee? How far west can you go? All the way to Tennessee? How could you even think of such a thing? So America is changing. America is developing. And in that change, in that development, certain characteristics of this new culture began to emerge rather quickly. And I want, as we go through in this lecture and others, to look at three characteristics that keep reappearing in various guises as we go along. The first is we are committed to freedom. Freedom is one of the characteristic commitments of Americans. Maybe sometimes more in our imagination than in our reality, but that's a ringing cry of American history. We are committed to freedom. And one of the ways that freedom was expressed, of course, was in our democracy, the founding of our republic, which was founded on rather sound, in my judgment, Calvinistic principles. Namely, we don't trust anybody. And so we have a government of checks and balances. We don't trust majorities. We don't trust minorities. We want checks and balances to keep power from accumulating to too great an extent in any one area of the life of the republic. We want a small government. That was very much an American commitment. And I think one can argue we didn't really have a very large central government until when? Even later, I think you could say the government doesn't really grow till Wilson. Well, FDR expands it. I think Wilson that good American Presbyterian president, was one of the first who really began the movement towards a significantly larger government, which of course was accelerated under FDR. It's interesting that the American commitment to freedom led to a more centralized government as America had to fight others who were opposed to freedom. So there are ironies in history, but we won't linger there either. Americans wanted, in the 19th century, decentralized government. We wanted the freedom to do what we wanted to do locally without a lot of central government interference. And Nathan Hatch, in his really important book, The Democratization of American Christianity, argued that part of what that meant was we rejected experts in America. There's a profound suspicion in America of experts. The first ones that we suspected in the early 19th century were lawyers. Who can trust a lawyer, I ask you? We all like to quote, is it Henry V, Shakespeare's great play, the first thing we do is kill all the lawyers. So experts in the law, who needs them? We can be our own law. And then we were very suspicious of doctors. Kellogg's and Post were men who started health food industry in the 19th century because people didn't think doctors knew what they were doing. Of course, in the 19th century, the doctors didn't know what they were doing. So it was not a completely irrational prejudice, but it set in motion this kind of prejudice and suspicion of experts. And who else should we suspect? What other experts should we reject? Lawyers. Now stop that back there. Not professors. Everyone loves a professor. I remember as a college kid going to study in Germany for about 6 months. I was 19. And they said, you're going to find things really different in Germany. And I said, well, in what way? And they said, well, for example, if you have a very famous celebrity speaking in one room and you have a professor speaking in another room, all the Germans will be there to listen to the professor because they revere experts. And I said, all the Americans would be in the room with a celebrity. You know, it's Taylor Swift and me. And I'm not going to ask where you all would be. Well, Nathan Hatch suggests in his book that it's lawyers and doctors and ministers. Who needs to listen to a minister? I know just as much as that bozo knows. That's an American prejudice. It's very interesting. Before the American Revolution, the attitude in American churches was, when the minister has spoken, that's what must be true. And the attitude was, I would never be able to decide what church to attend, because how would I have wisdom to decide what church to attend? I attend the church nearest to my home. That was the parish system in New England, where the churches were all congregational Calvinist churches. What church would you be attending if you went to the building closest to your home? Be an interesting exercise to find out where we would all be divided. But there was, you see, a kind of revolt against people who claimed to know. And part of the freedom we insisted we had as Americans is, I already know. I can know on my own. I can make decisions on my own. And even as we consider that, we realize there are good sides to that, and there are not so good sides to that. And we live with that very much as part of our commitment to freedom. So RFK, Robert Kennedy Jr., is sure he knows more about vaccine than any number of scientists and doctors. Well, I'm not going to take a side in that because I want you to like me. But it very much manifests that tendency in America to be very suspicious of experts. So freedom is the first characteristic. The second characteristic is individualism. We want to be rugged individualists. We want the freedom to be individualists. We want the freedom to do what we want to do. And one of the ways in which that expressed itself in America in a kind of fascinating way was in the kind of farms we developed. It's interesting to contrast farming in Europe with farming in America. Now, part of that difference is accounted for by the difference of the size of farms, or in Texas, ranches, that you have. In Europe, farms were very small because land was very valuable, very scarce. And people lived in the village together and would go out to their farmland to farm it and come back to the village at night. Now, what does that mean? It means you have community life in the village. It means you have a church in the village that everybody attends. It means there's a social relationship that exists. What happened in America? Because there was all of this land, people would start farms and later ranches with acres and acres and acres of land, and they would build a house in the middle of it, which meant they were hugely isolated from their neighbors. Neighbors could be a significant time of travel away. You wouldn't see your neighbors every night when you went back to the village. You might not see neighbors for days on end. There are descriptions of women in particular suffering what came to be known as prairie sickness. It was just a kind of loneliness for any kind of human contact. They were so isolated. But it was an expression, one of the expressions of American individualism. We want to do things on our own, in our own way, and sometimes that can be isolating. The third element that comes to be very characteristic of Americans is optimism. So we're committed to freedom, we're committed to individualism, and in that whole process, we're optimistic. We will make progress. We will make progress. I had to smile. We'll come back maybe and talk about this a little more later, but some of you may be old enough to remember Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell was a conservative preacher, and he, like many conservative preachers of his time, was committed to dispensationalism. Am I supposed to be a for it or against it? Well, dispensationalism, as developed by John Nelson Darby in Great Britain, was a completely culturally pessimistic understanding of how the future would unfold. Things were going to go from bad to worse in the culture and in the church. That was guaranteed. That's what original dispensationalism held. But American dispensationalists couldn't keep themselves from being optimistic. Optimism was so planted in the American spirit that what does Jerry Falwell do? He starts the moral majority. John Nelson Darby, I don't know if he had hair or not, but he would have pulled it out if he'd heard such a thing, a moral majority. But Americans are optimistic. We're optimistic that if we get through this presidential election, there'll be another. And that's our hope. We're going to have progress. We're going to move forward. And those characteristics of the culture then came to expression also in the churches. What were churches in America like in this same period? Well, first of all, there were the old denominations. Up until the time of the American Revolution, there were three denominations that were dominant in America. In New England, it was the Congregationalists. In the South, it was the Episcopalians. And in the muddy middle were the Presbyterians. You heard the story of how Presbyterians came to America. William Penn was distressed that the southeastern border of Pennsylvania was constantly being intruded upon by people from Maryland and Delaware. I don't think there were Bidens in Delaware then, but so he wanted to defend that southeastern border of Pennsylvania and discovered that Quakers did not make good defenders of borders. So William Penn said to himself, who are the most aggressive, pugnacious, bellicose people on the face of the earth? And imported a bunch of Scots-Irish Presbyterians. And so the Mid-Atlantic states became the home to American Presbyterianism. These are all denominations born from the Reformation, right? These are all denominations, when you look at their labels, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, Congregational, they're just divided by church government. That's what their names talk about. They're all three rooted in the Reformation. And historians have said at the time of the American Revolution, probably 90% of the colonial population in America were descended from Calvin's Geneva, theologically. 90%. Do you feel like you're one of the 90%ers today? After the Revolution, things began to change dramatically in America. And two denominations, or at least two religious groups, began to grow amazingly in the 19th century. So that by 1850, the two largest religious groups in America were the Methodists, who were almost nothing at the time of the Revolution, and the Baptists, who were also almost nothing at the time of the Revolution. And while these two groups had grown hugely, and grown particularly on the frontier as it pushed west, the growth of the Episcopalians, the Congregationalists, and, sorry to say, the Presbyterians had stalled significantly. They were growing, but nowhere like these other groups. And the new republic had decided absolutely they would have no religious establishment at the national level. They were not going to have a national church that the government supported and enforced. But in the early days of the republic, states were allowed to have a national church. Massachusetts and Connecticut, well into the 19th century, still had special support for the congregational churches. Virginia had special support for the Episcopal Church for some time. But increasingly, the government got out of the business of supporting denominations, but remained in the business of supporting, in general, a Protestant establishment to America. America may not have had a national church or an established church, but America was clearly a Protestant country. And one of the ways we know that, fascinatingly, is when Roman Catholics began to immigrate to America in significant numbers in the 19th century, Irish, Italians, Eastern Europeans. What was one of the first things that leaders of the Roman Catholic immigration concluded? One of the first things they concluded was, we will not send our children to the public schools because they're Protestant schools. We need Catholic schools where our children can be educated in the Catholic faith. And we sort of forget that because at least most of our schools are no longer Protestant in a committed way. I don't know how things are in Texas. I can assure you they are not Protestant in California. And in this interesting emerging of a new religious character to the Protestant establishment in America, I would argue in the 19th century we have a new religion that takes over. It doesn't necessarily have a clear denominational character, but it begins to take over the existing denominations. And that new religion is evangelicalism. evangelicalism. Now, I have evangelical friends who would object strenuously to my argument that evangelicalism is a new religion. As one noted historian said, evangelicals believe this. The Apostle Paul was Billy Graham with a Greek accent. In other words, evangelicals tend to believe there's no real history between the Bible and evangelicalism. And at the risk of offending you all, or maybe with the intention of offending you all, I would want to argue that evangelicalism is its own kind of religion. Doesn't make it bad, it just makes it a little different. Because what evangelicalism says is, all of our Protestant denominations are agreed around a central core of commitment to the Bible as our religious authority, and a religious core that we're committed to the necessity of conversion, both conversion in individual lives, but also conversion in society. We want to make society different. And we need to be united about that. We need to focus on that. We need to be united about upholding the Bible, and we need to be united about bringing people to religious conversion, and we need to be united about seeing the country change through religious conversion. And this social conversion in 19th century America took many forms. It was there were all sorts of organizations to pursue all sorts of good moral causes. So you had rescue missions in cities. You had anti-dueling societies. You had the Lord's Day League to protect the Sabbath day. You could just go right down the line. You, of course, had the Women's Temperance Union to oppose alcohol. And one could argue, perhaps, that the last great victory of evangelicalism in this country came in 1919 with prohibition. At last, we have outlawed demon rum. And it's interesting, now historians look back and say, you know, prohibition did a lot of good. There was a lot less drunkenness in the country. You know, all we read about is, you know, all the speakeasies. But the truth is, there was a lot of moral improvement in this country, a lot less drunkenness in this country. So let's go back and revive them. But it was part of this vision that we'll be able to change the country. We'll be able to bring in a golden age. We'll be able to bring in a time of real freedom, because the churches too could embrace the idea of freedom. Freedom from sin, freedom from hate, freedom from the lies of the devil, freedom from death. What did Jesus come to give us? John 8, freedom. If the Son shall make you free, you will be free indeed. So that too could be embraced by the churches. And individualism. Individualism. Think of how the Baptist churches spread with their idea of believers' baptism. So every believer has to make a decision as an individual to be baptized. The whole notion of a corporate connection to one another was challenged. Again, I'm not taking sides now. I'm just being descriptive. I have a side if you want to know. But here it is in real practice, that individualism was expressed in congregationalism. All the Baptist churches are congregationalist churches. We decide as individuals in these churches who's going to be minister, how long the minister is going to stay, how poor can we keep him, All these decisions were made by individuals in the congregations, and that brought an involvement in the life of the church that was entirely foreign to Europe. European churches, the buildings were maintained by the government. The ministers were paid by the government. Those buildings were protected, and those ministers were paid, whether the church was full or whether there was no one there. It didn't matter. And so the laity kind of adopted the attitude, increasingly in 19th century Europe, we don't matter to the church. We are not the church. The church is the building and that group of educated experts that we don't really trust anyway. But in America, you didn't have a church building from government taxes. Now, maybe occasionally we think that might be a better use of tax money than some of the things they do with taxes. But we don't really believe that, do we? We only have church buildings if the laity gather the money. We only have congregations if the laity are committed to there being a congregation. The life of the church is dependent on the laity. And there's a wonderful book on the history of American Christianity called The Triumph of the Laity. Now, the downside of that is it has tended to put ministers in competition with one another for the laity. Who could attract the most people? But the vitality of the American church, which so amazed and surprised Europeans in the 19th and 20th century, is because the laity felt and realized the church exists or doesn't exist only on our involvement or non-involvement. And it was the passionate commitment of the laity that was so crucial. And that was linked to optimism. What was the dominant eschatology in America amongst Protestants in the 17th, 18th, 19th century? It was what today we call postmillennialism. Things are going to get better. More people are going to be converted. We are going to see the church flourish and grow. We're going to see more and more people come into the church. We're going to see the impact of the church changing society and changing culture until we have so much progress that Jesus will come back to cap the glory that he's accomplished by his Holy Spirit on earth. We were optimists through and through for most of the history of the American church. Now, it's interesting how, by and large, postmillennialism has died out, but the optimism remains in the hearts of many, many Americans. The downside of that optimism in the 19th century was there were many voices that began to say, well, you know, that old religion that we heard so much about, that Calvinism, talks about original sin and total depravity and human helplessness. That can't be right. Arminianism makes a lot more sense. We can help ourselves. We have natural ability. We can respond. We can do it. That's the American way. And lo and behold, the spirit of Arminianism became more and more powerful. Not all-consuming, but more and more powerful in the American churches. And when Presbyterians said, now wait a minute, we believe in original sin. We even practice it. We believe in total depravity. We believe in irresistible grace to regenerate hearts. The evangelicals said, Well, you can believe that if you really need to, but don't talk about it. It might harm the evangelical unity. Now do you begin to see how that new religion, claiming just to be unitive, is in fact suppressive of the distinctives of Reformation religion? Presbyterians didn't seem to get it in the 19th century. I think it's because they were optimistic. They thought, well, you know, as the millennial age approaches, we'll be able to convert all these Arminians to being good Calvinists. Two of the groups that sort of stayed somewhat outside this evangelical alliance were the Lutherans, because the Lutherans stressed the importance of sacraments in a way that the evangelicals didn't want to hear talked about, and the Dutch Reformed, because Dutch people just don't like anyone else. I am Dutch Reformed, so I can pick on my own people. But the Dutch were ethnically isolated to some extent and stayed out of this evangelical world. So here we have religion flourishing in the New World. Incredible numbers of church buildings built, an incredible level of church attendance taking place, an incredible amount of charitable work being done, an amazing number of colleges and schools being founded. I don't think we even have a sense of how many Presbyterian colleges were founded in 19th century America. Some of them didn't survive, but the push to establish all sorts of Christian institutions was remarkable. And so there was this flourishing. One historian has talked about 19th century American church history as the evangelical empire that seemed to be going from strength to strength. But we have to end on a down note. The millennium did not come. Charles Finney once said in a revival, if we just work hard enough, the millennium will come in 3 years. You people have not been working hard enough. So America sees religion flourishing. It's flourishing in the context of Christendom support. It's flourishing in the context of freedom and individualism and optimism. It's flourishing with the evangelical empire having been established. But by the late 19th and early 20th century, there were concerns, and that's what we're going to turn to look at tomorrow morning. So thank you all for your very kind attention.